Hi, I'm Eric Nie, Managing Editor of Stanford Social Innovation Review, which aims to inform and inspire leaders of social change. Learn more at ssir.org. In this talk from our Frontiers of Social Innovation Forum, Trabian Shorters explains why it's important to focus on people's positive assets rather than their faults. Shorters is the founder and CEO of Be Me Community, a national network that promotes and celebrates the contributions of Black men.
Good morning. All right. So, look, I know that this has been one of these conferences where people come with these really big ideas and they try to sort of shake your understanding of things and make you uncomfortable and get you into spaces that you hadn't thought about. And that's exactly what I intend to do. But before I get started, I'm just curious, how many people here really enjoy talking about America's racial issues? Like, you get up in the morning thinking, man, I just want to just, you know, throw your... Oh, wow, a lot more than I would expect, okay? I've never gotten that reaction, so now I'm a little thrown off. The gist of the conversation that we're going to have is about framing, right? It's about, you know, the big picture, you know, the really big picture, right? And by that, I mean the frame, the mental frames that our stories exist within. When I was at the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, we funded a number of different challenge initiatives in different communities. I was vice president of our communities. We worked in 26 cities across the country. And the idea that got Be Me started was this one. You know, what if we started with knowledge of each other's value and built from there rather than defining each other as, you know, bottom of this or under that, or terms that you might be familiar with. Because I worked in communities, we intersected a lot of the issues that I'm sure you get to think about and talk about. But one of the, and don't worry about all these words, I'll talk about it. But one of the sort of pivotal discoveries was in every city where there had been some sort of catastrophe, two types of folks always emerged. And whether we're talking about the floods in the Dakotas, which was one of our towns, or you're talking about Katrina in some of our other towns, or you're talking about the type of financial collapse that happened in Detroit, every time there was a catastrophe, there were two really, really virulent actors that showed up. One we call the builders, and the others we call the fixers. The interesting thing about the fixers, and you'll be familiar with them, they were the ones who were most interested in restoring, rebuilding, reviving, returning to this, you know, ideal world that probably never existed, but at least in memory, that's how they wanted it. And the second group, and in particular in Detroit, you can see this, came the builders, right? Builders saw the devastation as a chance to build something new, the clean slate, the chance to create in spaces where there hadn't been that type of creation before. And the significance of this was, of course, the fixers pretty much hated the builders, right? The fixers had a sense that this was our town, this is our past, we want, you know, even if you rebuild things, it'll never be like it was, you know, that sort of thing. And the builders, of course, saw little reason to pay attention to who already lived there. Obviously, you need both. And you can see up there that one is more crisis-oriented and one is more vision-oriented. But I really don't think one is worse than the other. I just think it's important to recognize both. The other epiphany that helped us think about our future was we are living right now in a time that has never existed in the history of the nation, literally. We are at this moment where the baby boomers, who are also the civil rights generation, have defined everything about American personality and culture and policy because they were such a huge swath of the populace. And they've done that for the last 50 years. And you know that because they're celebrating the 50th anniversary of, you know, everything. but, you know, right now, the millennials and the iGen generation, you know, they're an even bigger generation than the boomers were. They're the most diverse, the most digitally connected generation in the history of the country. We are the last generation of America's white majority. The generation that will be that will have no racial majority is in school right now. So the fact of the matter is, if we don't adjust our racial frames, right, which were designed to serve mostly white men, but if we don't adjust those frames to be more inclusive, as I've heard you say, then we really are going to lose opportunity. You know, America's going to continue to grow, but it'll grow at a rate much slower. than it could if we really had the type of future that we all want and imagine. So these are the three stages of my talk. I'm gonna ask you to be honest, I'm gonna ask you to be fair, I'm gonna ask you to be good to your family. You're not gonna be allowed to sit still for this whole talk, so just get used to the fact that in a moment I'm gonna ask you to do some things that you might not enjoy, but you'll probably laugh just the same. So be honest. How many of you have heard these negative statistics? I'm gonna read them off one by one. I'm gonna ask you to signify by doing certain things, right? So raise your hand if you've heard stats that point out that black poverty rate is still a major problem in the US, 150 years after the Civil War. Just if you've heard that, oh my gosh, look around, look at this. Okay, so we all know that narrative, that's good. Now, stand up if you've observed that black and brown folks are often the faces of, you know, major problems like poverty and incarceration, all that. Okay. This is our country, all right, so we all recognize that. And you see the third thing is, if you've heard that black boys continue to drop out at alarming rates, just one rotation. You know what a twirl is? There you go, that's what a twirl is. Now, all right, you can have a seat. You may wonder why I asked you to do, why you have to stand up and even go as far as to spin. It's because you're giving the control of the room to someone who likes to play with people, so. so that might happen. Now, you all saw and could feel how familiar we are with these narratives of the problem. So now I'm gonna ask you if you could do these three things, right? On the positive narrative, would you find somebody at your table and high-five them if you know how many black millionaires there are? Just, if you know how many black millionaires there are in the United States, I don't hear any high-fiving, okay. Remember, I asked that question because we can quote the poverty rates. I just wanted to know if we could quote the millionaire rates, right? And for those of us who can quote the dropout rates, if you have some sense of how many black boys are in college, you know, just dap somebody. You familiar with dap? This is a cultural reference. It just means to give someone a positive touch, an affirming touch, you know, the pound, the whatever. But if you know somebody, or if you're familiar with this number, how many black boys are actually in college, those of you who are familiar with the dropout rates? Okay. This last one we're gonna change up because you all might not know each other well enough to do HR compliant hugging. So what we'll ask instead is just raise your hand if you out of America's different dominant racial groups, which one actually gives the highest percentage to charity? If you know that, just raise your hand. Okay, good. We got a few people hugging themselves. You can tell that we are all very familiar with the deficit frame, but when you look around, very few of us who care about poverty and education and these issues, very few of us can quote the asset frame, right? Very few of us can say positive things about these populations. So then the question becomes, you know, who do you think we are? Because you can literally only tell the story of some of these populations that you say you care about, but one way. And it happens to be the way that, you know, you probably wouldn't want to be identified, right? If you had a friend that you were introducing to another friend, I seriously doubt that you would introduce them by saying, "Hi, this is my friend John. He used to wet the bed as a child and his mother was on welfare." That's not the way, that's not the way that we introduce ourselves to one another. So it is curious that we choose to introduce the folks that we say we care the most about by the characteristic that least validates them, that leaves them the most not a part of the American polis. So now I wanna move and get you breathing again to this opportunity to be fair to yourself. If you could turn to someone at your table, and I'm gonna ask you to do something in a moment, it'll only take 5 seconds, but right now you're figuring out who you wanna turn to, so that's good. But in a moment, I'm gonna ask you to turn to your neighbor and I want you to do one thing, okay? Don't look at me, look at the person sitting next to you. So turn to your neighbor. For those of you who've been in church, turn to your neighbor. Okay. Now, what I want you to do, no, don't talk to him. come back. All right, I want you to turn to your neighbor and in silence, all I want you to do, no, you can look at them, don't look at me. All I want you to do in silence is try to notice everything you can about what is wrong with this person looking back at you. No, don't tell them. No, but you can stop. You can stop. You can stop. I think you get the point, right? I am going to ask you, though, you know, I've done this a lot of times, and every time it's the same reaction. Everyone always laughs. But anyone want to share why you laugh? Why do you laugh?
We have the same haircut.
Well, that's funny all by itself. You're right. But really, so I've done this a lot, and people laugh pretty much for the same reasons every time, right? It's uncomfortable, you know, usually. And something inside of you knows that it's just plain wrong to look at someone, and the first thing you do is try to figure out their fault, right? But very often in our helping spaces, this is how we approach the folk that we think we're helping, right? And the funny thing is, I come from philanthropy, so this is not me talking about you, this is me talking about us. The funny thing about it is we tend to refer to our populations this way and have a hard time engaging them. And we, for some reason, cannot make the connection, right? If you have people in your life who choose to define you and reference you and refer to you by something that you really don't want to be identified with, I would encourage you to get them out of your life, find new friends. The world is a very good place if you can have good people in it. Look, the point I'm trying to make is we don't define each other in this space by our challenges. Everyone has challenges, right? But to define someone by their challenge is the definition of stigmatizing them. That's what it means. If you have a cousin or a sister or brother in the family who's become the black sheep, right? Seems like no matter what, Chuck or Sarah or whoever she is always screwing something up, you know? When that happens, we tend to literally ignore when they're doing something to the contrary of whatever image we've created. And that's because, truthfully, the stories we tell create the life that we'll live. And this is not something that I made up, you know, to be cute. This idea comes from a leading research psychologist. I'll get to this in a moment. But I just want to share something a little personal to bring it home for you. 20-odd years ago, I was at a national conference, and it was put on by the Points of Light Foundation. It was in D.C. There were like 1,000 people. And out of the whole set, there may have been 20 or so black folks who were in my age group. So we would meet in someone's room each night to have basically the same conversations that had taken place earlier, only we'd do it, you know, just sort of among friends, right? And I'm sure you've had similar experiences. And I remember there was a guy who, you know, we were introducing ourselves to one another, and the guy before me said, you know, my name is so-and-so, I'm from this city, my dad wasn't in the house, this community was dangerous, I had no positive black male role models growing up. And then it was my turn, I said, you know, my name is Trabian, I'm from Pontiac, my father wasn't in the house, community was dangerous, I had no positive black male role models growing up, and that's why I'm committed to the work I do. And then the third person started to run down that same narrative, and there was this woman who was maybe 20 years our senior, named Octavia Wilson. And when the third guy started up, Octavia said, wait, why do you keep saying that? Do you mean to tell me you never had an uncle or a cousin, you never had a grandfather, you know, your mother never dated anyone who knew which end was up, you really had no positive black male role models? And for me, it was like she had turned the light on in the room. Because of course, you know, my grandfather was a minister, he was the bedrock of the family, quiet guy, humble guy, but a strong guy. My Uncle Charles had gone off and fought in Vietnam and came back and was a family man, raised his family, you know, committed. And my mother, see, I'm from a pretty rough place called Pontiac. My mother had dated a guy named Swoop, who, when he was done being a gangster, taught me a lot about commitment to my family, and he was a very solid man. So between the minister, the soldier, and the gangster, I learned a lot about being a man, caring for your community, and taking care of the things that need to be taken care of. But I bring that up to say, why then was I repeating a story about my life that was factually inaccurate? It had become a very popular story to tell. It spoke to the pain that I felt about my father not being there and about the danger in the community, but it just wasn't true. There was no way in the world that I would be standing here on this stage were it not for those three men, because my community was dangerous. My father wasn't in the house. We were poor. All those things were real. So how is it that I was able to go from there to here if not for Reverend Hutchins, Charles Bosworth, and Swoop? So the stories we tell literally create the opportunities we see and the opportunities that we don't see. And factually, whether you're in the US or some other parts of the world, human beings use stories as a form of grooming, of tribalism, right? And every story has a structure of something like this, and this is going to be important later in the talk, but I really want to step through this with you. In every story, the hero is identifiable by some admirable quality and some aspiration that he or she may have. The problem is always identifiable by some negative, limited, or dangerous stigma associated with it. And then, of course, the goal of the story is always to achieve something that's good for the tribe overall. And that structure matters right down to the goal because if you think about it, a story of someone becoming a drug kingpin for most of us is not a hero story. for most of us, someone learning, telling the story of how they became an abuser of their family, that person is not a hero. The hero has to pursue something that the tribe finds socially valuable, right? Typically, as it says here on the bottom line, the typical deals with a problem and subdues it for the good of the tribe. I mentioned a moment ago that narrative, to me, is the biggest possible change. Because if you're telling a story where all you can quote is the negative statistics about some group, then your mind literally has no association of their value. You literally can't tell that story. And if you can't tell that story, then you can't double down on their value because you don't know it. It doesn't occur to you to engage some populations in ways that you could if you value them the way that you value others, right? And so narrative and narrative frame, I think, is the biggest possible change. There's a reason that politicians create a narrative before they get us to go to war. There's a reason that we create narratives before we decide which party is the good party and which party is the bad party, right? And as I mentioned before, your mind is literally prone to disregard facts that don't fit your narrative. One of the funny things about human beings is, when surveyed, typically, no matter which town you're in, 75% of people believe that they are above average drivers. And for those of you who can do math, that's not possible. But that's the narrative. And we have this research comes from a guy named Daniel Kahneman. I'm sure you've heard of him. He's a Nobel laureate. He talks about this thing called cognitive illusions. The stat I just quoted about driving, that's a cognitive illusion. But very often our perceptions about the disadvantaged and the underprivileged and the bottom of this, whatever, those also tend to be prone to cognitive illusions. So I'm curious, in doing the work, we identified four popular morals to the stories that baby boom generation folk grew up on, right? And I'm not saying necessarily that you believe these things. I'm going to sort of silently poll you in a moment. And by silent, I mean you don't have to raise hands. Just think to yourself. But have you heard people give speeches, make addresses, try to land political points that whose moral of the story is that people of color want privileges they haven't earned, right? Or that the problems and threats, this is popular in the philanthropic space that I'm in, the problem and threats that black males represent to society must be neutralized, right? These are obvious problems of incarceration or violence or whatever you name it, right? But that's sort of the moral of a lot of the stories you hear in philanthropy. This third one is popular when someone is accused of some sort of crime, right? They deserve whatever happens to them. The moment that you've been accused of something, whatever it is, whatever happens after that, you kind of brought it on yourself, right? If a kid is acting out in the classroom or, whatever, like whatever this weird thing is, we sort of turn off our human empathy with this moral frame, right? And then, of course, this one is historic, so tried and true. Right? Any gains by one group is automatically a loss for others, right? Because there's no such thing as growth in America. We don't have ingenuity. It's a fixed pie. And if you get a piece of my pie, then somehow I will starve, right? Not rooted in reality, but it's a really good frame when you're trying to get people to stay apart rather than come together. When I was forming Be Me, one of the things that we did was we asked a lot of black men in particular what were the causes and issues that they cared about. And to my surprise, the issues that they named and that they were willing to take initiative on at a really high rate were things related to youth development, education, economic opportunity, public safety, and matters of the environment. These were the things that black folks, that these black males really cared about. And of course, I looked at those that list and I said, well, geez, which one of these is the racial issue, right? Who, you know, only black guys care about education or economic opportunity? Or it turns out that we all care about the same things. So the question is, why don't we come together? Why is it in every city that we do our work in, with lots of good folk just like you, whether they're working on education or they're working on issues of economic opportunity, at the top of the leadership circles, it tends to look like the 1950s, right? We got whites only and blacks only and Latinos only. You know, we somehow we don't do a good job of coming together, even though truthfully we share similar desires for our country. And I believe these narratives play a really important role in why it's so difficult for us to do that. So let's get into the story that you tell. In a moment, I'm going to ask you to do something. This one won't be nearly as uncomfortable as the other thing. This is very easy. It's very interactive. It's very simple, okay? In a moment, I'm going to ask you to think of your favorite cause, right? I'm just curious, how many people here actually work in, let's call it, nonprofit land? Okay, good. So you're familiar with causes. That's good. So in a moment, I'm going to ask you at your table, and you can turn to the same person if you want to, or you can pick someone else. I'm going to ask you to turn to someone at your table, and all I want you to do is talk to them about an organization that's working on your favorite cause. Okay? And say a little bit about who they help, how they help, whatever the narrative is. Okay? Is that clear enough? Okay. So when I tell you to, I want you to turn and do that. The only catch is you can't use these words, okay? So you're gonna talk for just a minute, and you're not gonna use these words. Go. Okay, and if you're at a table with someone who likes to talk, you should think about switching, giving somebody else a chance. You're gonna go back and forth with this, okay? Great. Okay, good. So I'm curious in those of you who, please quiet down so that somebody can actually hear what I'm saying. Okay, now, I'm curious how many people here enjoyed that conversation just now, right? Okay, and I'm curious, did anyone, you know, have any challenge not using these type of words? Okay, there's honesty. I like honest people. That's good. So you raise your hand. Everybody else is pretending like it was easy for them, but I appreciate you being forthright. And to be very, you know, sort of candid with everyone, this is really what Be Me, and this is what the talk that I'm doing, this is what it's about. It's about recognizing that, honestly, we all care. No matter which skin you're born in, no matter whether they give you a penis or whether you don't have a penis, whatever the deal is, we actually do all care about the same things. And when we have a chance to engage each other around what we care about, we get excited, right? I'm curious, did anyone here find it in any way uncomfortable to have that conversation we just had? Yeah, people dug, okay, yeah. Okay, we'll do it in Q&A then. So here's the thing. If we all enjoy talking about causes that matter to us, we all enjoy making the world a better place, why are our rooms, you know, so monochromatic or so, you know, boy or girl? Like, why do we tend to not be able to come together around this other identity, our cause identity, right? No matter which skin you're born in, the causes that you care about bridge our birth characteristics. I believe in part it's a simple psychological trap that we fall into, right? In narrative. How many of you have ever seen a program that has a narrative that's, you know, a mission statement that's something like, our program helps at-risk youth in high crime neighborhoods stay on track, graduate school, and avoid becoming a negative statistic? Okay. So raise them high. I'm just curious how many folks have heard. Okay, yeah, right? So this is not unfamiliar. Given what we've just walked through about narrative and our sense of who we are, I'm curious, who's the hero in this story? Well, who is? In this story, who's the hero? Ah, we are. All right. We are a program. Well, then, who's the problem? Who is? The at-risk youth. Right? If we are heroically out there protecting society from these ne'er-do-wells, that's a pretty fascinating way to introduce our friends, you know? And here's the part that made me willing to leave philanthropy and work on this in a more intentional way with folks who share some of our values. Here's the market dilemma, right? It's actually funders who engender this language that you have to use, right? If you've ever worked in a program, when the like a youth program, when the students walk in, you probably don't say, "Hey, you underprivileged, at risk, whatever, come have a seat." Like, that's probably not the way you greet them, right? But when it's time to write your grant proposal, you're given language and words that you have to use. I remember when I first got into philanthropy, it was funny to me how whatever word Knight Foundation switched to as our emphasis, we would get grants that always had that word in it, right? Like whatever, I sincerely wanted to say that we're really interested in butternut squash, just to see how many programs work on butternut squash all of a sudden, right? But the point is, you know, the funders create this language and you need their funding, right? It's the lifeblood of your organization, right? To get those grants. But the problem is you get that blood money for telling the story of death, destruction, fear, and threat that people who are probably not much different from you represent in a different circumstance. And if you solve the problem, funnily enough, or actually, if you don't solve the problem, then of course you lose your funding. But funnily enough, if you do solve the problem, you'll lose your funding, right? This is the catch-22 of deficit framing, right? You're not actually, if you want to survive, you can't actually solve the problem, right? So what ends up happening is that we treat and never cure, right? Over time, it contributes to a sense of cynicism, people disengage, and you're reducing hope. I remember Martin Luther King Jr. speaking about how there were 40 million poor people in the U.S. at the time that he made the speech. And I was at the foundation, and it turns out there were 40 million poor people in the U.S. 3 years ago, right? Now, the population has grown, so, you know, relatively, I guess that's progress. But people really do have a sense of stagnation, irritation, dissatisfaction with the way things keep going, right? So much so that we have all kind of craziness happening in our election this year. You know, you got socialists running and women, like anything can happen. It's crazy. So let's now take a chance to be good to our family, okay? This is the last part of my address to you. I'm going to get into some pathways that we've discovered and some things that we're doing that we think are solutions. The very first one is this thing called asset framing. And by that, we mean that asset framing is defining people by their aspirations and their contributions, then acknowledging their challenges and investing in them for their continued benefit to society, right? And if you contrast that against our typical narrative frame and our mission statements, our typical narrative is deficit framed, right? It says that we're defining people by their problems, ignoring their contributions, which is why you can't quote these stats that I asked earlier. You can't quote them because who knows them? We don't talk about them. It's as if they don't exist, all those positive stats, right? So we define people by their problems, we ignore their contributions, and then we remediate them for the benefit of society, right? That's deficit frame. Asset frame, obviously, is different. So in an asset frame story, if you look at this same narrative, our program helps at-risk youth in high-crime neighborhoods to stay on track. How might, you know, the same organization express its mission? And I won't make you workshop it right here. I've done this many times before. I can give you the cheat sheet. One thing that we ask organizations to do is to recognize that because you're asset framing, the people you're working with have aspirations, right? If you have students, they aspire to go to college. They aspire to graduate. They're hungry for an education. There's lots of ways to describe them, right? But we found that a simple shift in perspective to where you are the help in someone's aspiration for themselves and society gets you out of this trap language, gets you out of that catch-22, right? I've given you four specific denigrating frames. They were: people of color are burdens on society. The threats that black boys represent have to be neutralized. They deserve whatever happens to them. And a gain for one group is a loss for another. These are morals to the story that we tell each other a lot in our media. Well, in Be Me and working with literally hundreds of folk across the country, we came up with a different set of values that we are intentional about reinforcing, right? One is that valuing all members of the human family is the most important, is the most prosperous way forward for America, right? That's one value that we're intentional about sharing. The second is that black men are assets to society and important members of that family. The third is to reject narratives that denigrate anyone. And the fourth is to work together in asset-oriented ways to build a more caring and prosperous community. Be Me, and I'll talk about Be Me in a moment, but Be Me community is literally built on these values. The men, women, and children in the network are encouraged to repeat, work, and live according to this credo, because it turns out we actually already believe it. It's not like we have to invent something. How many folks here were like, oh, I can't do this. This is not, you know, there's nothing crazy about this, but you have to elevate a narrative in order for it to be readily accessible in our minds. So I asked you a number of questions at the front of the hour. Here's the answers, right? When I asked about how many black millionaires are in the United States, this data is actually old. It's from a census maybe 12 years ago now. I just couldn't find the more current data. But when that was taken, there are 110,000 black households whose net worth was greater than, you know, $1 million, so we just translate that as millionaires. The reason why I like to sometimes share this data is because if you add up all of the like millionaire, you know, sports stars who are black and all the millionaire entertainers who are black, like if you just crunch the math on it, you might get to 5,000 maybe, you know, between the different leagues and retired players and all that stuff. But if the number is 110,000, then it's worth trying to figure out what the other 95% of, you know, black millionaires do. I get to speak a lot in black communities, as you might imagine, and I like to point this stat out because most of the kids, having only heard one story of success, aspire to the wrong end of the equation. 39.8% of African-American boys between the ages of 18 and 24 are in college right now or have their college degree. And lastly, some of you knew, black households give 25% more of their income to charity than the national average. Same people, different picture, right? So the moral of this story that I'm trying to share with you all is that there's nothing wrong with recognizing the value of other people. It won't hurt your funding opportunities, and it might increase your growth opportunities. I mentioned that we are in a historic time. I literally believe that with the baby boomers starting to get into retirement age and the millennials starting to get into the prime of their professional life, we're at a moment of decision in America where we have to decide, are we going to continue to live out these divisive narratives? Or are we going to come together in a nation that will have no racial majorities? Are we going to recognize each other, define each other by our worth and our contribution? And then you can acknowledge problems, right? But it's a very different thing to define someone as a problem than it is to acknowledge their setbacks, but to value them right from the beginning. We've done this in Be Me community. I'm going to close out with these few slides. Be Me provides an optimistic, fact-based, aspirational narrative of black men, their cities, and related causes. It complements other change strategies. It enters cultural dialogues without denigrating anyone. One of the things that's interesting, we've been doing this now for 5 years, and we're in cities like, you know, Baltimore, Detroit, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh. We're in some places that have real racial friction, right? And the curious thing about our work, and by the way, we have funded men. We funded about 160 now men. We have funded men who have been convicted of major crimes. You know, it wasn't a mistaken identity. Like, they really did it long ago. And their commitment to the communities is off the charts, right? Very genuine. But I bring it up to say that many times when I was in philanthropy land, the idea of funding a former felon to work in the schools was a non-starter. Like, it just wasn't going to happen, right? Even in schools that were so bereft that they have been described as worse, in worse condition than the prisons that these men have come out of, right? And we found that when you engage these brothers around their choice identity, their utter commitment to the well-being of their communities, you get a totally different level of engagement from that community. Because these are the men and women that they've come, that the community itself has come to trust. And it's very hard to build a relationship with them if you're gonna stand behind these false identifications of yourself and of them. So we enter the cultural dialogue in a way that doesn't denigrate anyone, by the way. We don't blame, you know, folks born white. We don't blame folks who happen to have some income, you know, and some money in the bank. Like, all that stuff is cool. Everyone's defined by their sense of commitment to the well-being of the community. Here are a few things that we've accomplished. I'm not going to necessarily belabor these. The only one that I think I really want to share a little bit about is we released a book last year called Reach, 40 Black Men Speak on Living, Leading, and Succeeding, and it was gobbled up. I was really surprised by how fast it sold, how quickly it became a bestseller. I really do believe that America wants a new narrative on this stuff. I really believe that the people in this room would work with folk of any race or gender if they knew how, without running into all these barriers that we tend to see. This is a couple of our BME leaders. I just like showing pictures of these guys. BME has grown to 35,000 members of all races and genders in the last few years. We are working on an app because we actually want to create a social network of community builders, right? If there could be a LinkedIn, a Facebook, for folks who are just committed to making community stronger, we're working on that right now. We have great partners in putting it together. The idea is to make it easier for us to come together across race, class, and gender. And we believe that we are the people that we've been waiting for. This is my team. How many folks here have a staff that, you know, has more than maybe 50% millennials on it? Okay, it's weird, isn't it? Okay. Well, this is my team. They're mostly under 30, and they help keep me straight. I'm going to wrap up with one last story, and then I'm going to ask you to stand up and do something, okay? One of our BME leaders is a guy named Shaka Singur. If you've had a chance to hear about him or see him, great. If you haven't, Shaka was released from prison in 2010 after serving 19 years for murder. He was a Detroit drug dealer. He had shot and killed a man in a drug deal gone bad when he was 19 years old. Then he spent the next 19 years behind bars. Shaka will tell you that he was not a model prisoner. You know, he spent almost 7 of those years in solitary confinement for crimes that he committed while in prison, right? But over that time, he did have a change, a dramatic change, brought about by a note from his son that he didn't get to meet before he went to prison. And by the time Shaka got out of prison, he had made a commitment to being a builder rather than a destroyer. He got out in 2010. In 2011, he was asked to submit his story for BME. BME shared his story. Then we asked him in 2012 to apply for a grant. He did. Then in 2013, he became a BME leader, and we plugged him into other folks in our network who care about some of the same things that Shaka might care about. Fast forward now, 3 years later, Shaka just this year released his book, Righting My Wrongs. Among its fans was Oprah Winfrey. So she invited him onto the show and onto Super Soul Sunday, and he told about his life a couple months ago. And Shaka, in the last 3 years, has become an MIT fellow. He's given a TED talk called Why Our Worst Deeds Shouldn't Define Us. This very same man who was nothing but a drug dealer is an MIT fellow, is a TED talker, is a Kellogg fellow, is working for an organization called Cut 50, whose mission is to cut the prison population in half in the next decade. And we believe these kinds of things are only made possible so rapidly when we choose to define each other by our assets. So I'm gonna ask you to stand up now, if you would. The talk began with the question, I don't know if you remember the first slide, but right at the top it said, who do you love, right? And are you for sure, for those of you who know that rap song. But we asked, who do you love? As much as metrics and growth and strategy are really, really important, what we found the most transformational thing happening in the lives of these men in these communities is they figured out what they love, right? They figure out what they're willing to do for what they love. And we believe that if we're ever gonna have a shot at an America that leaves the past in the past and gets to the doing of making the world what we would want it to be, We're going to have to change some things that we believe about each other. So if you could pick somebody at your table, just turn to them. We're going to do something. Now, again, if you've been to church, this will be familiar. We're going to do something. And of course, it's voluntary. You don't have to do it if you don't want to. But I'm going to say some words. And if you agree with them, repeat them to the person across from you, okay? All right. So I refuse to define you by your faults. I recognize the good in you. And that's what I will relate to. I believe that all people should be valued. And that even includes you. Last two sentences. It's important that we be good to one another. Because I love us some us. Embrace your neighbor, have a seat. Now, I know we have a little bit of time for Q&A. I left out a lot of stories in there because I have tons of stories, whether it's from the tech world or the philanthropy world or just working in communities. But BME's approach has been very dramatic and very positive and very successful. And I'm happy to answer any questions about the topics that we got into in the course of the conversation.
So it isn't so much a question as a vocabulary. My wicked past, I worked in Belfast, Northern Ireland with young people who had seen the inside of a prison and at one point called them at risk, at which one of them said, I'm not at risk, Jean, I'm stuck. And because I'm stuck, you're at risk.
That's right. That's right. I love that.
Then he reminded me, everything human gets stuck.
That's right.
And it's something we share.
Amen. That's right. Thank you. Yes, sir.
I'm Alec Roberts, Executive Director of Community Housing Innovations, a nonprofit that's the largest provider of housing for the homeless outside of New York City.
Fantastic.
And I have a diverse staff, probably 50% African American, for the case managers I'm talking about. And basically, we deal mostly with African Americans in the homeless problem.
Sure.
And I asked them a question, because right now, the areas that we serve are outside of the city, largely segregated suburbs, Westchester County, which is kind of ground zero for this whole fight on inequality and trying to get social mobility. I asked them a question. All of the homeless pretty much are in high poverty, you know, areas, which they allegedly come from, even if they don't come from, they allegedly come from.
Sure.
And I challenged the case managers, again, half of whom are African American, that if you ask them if they would want to be willing to move from Mount Vernon or Yonkers, where they were, to Bronxville, Pelham, Bedford, Rye,
yep.
Scarsdale,
yep.
What would they say? And these are people that deal with their clients every day. You know, they're talking to them, they have to know what they're doing, they're trying to get them job training. And they all said to me, 100%, they wouldn't want to move.
That's right.
Why wouldn't they want to move? They said, well, they would feel uncomfortable because of these areas that are, you know, 95% white, and therefore they would rather stay with their own type, you know, inner
sure.
things. So I said, let's test that hypothesis. So, okay. All right, so the question was, all right, so the final thing was, when we asked them, would they want to move to these areas, two-thirds said absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Better schools,
better parks,
the same reason. Sure. So I just want to say that really this is the kind of testing and engagement that's really needed, you know, in the nonprofit sector among social service agents.
Thank you, and I agree. You know, one of the things we did when we were doing the pre-work for BME was we asked a number of different groups to give us data on, for instance, what percentage of or how many, you know, black professionals were there in places like Philadelphia, or what is the literal financial, you know, value of the different populations? And no one could tell us. Literally, no one could tell us. We went to the Urban League, no one tracks this data, right? And so subsequently, we're doing strategies that totally ignore financial assets. And we often do strategies, for instance, on things like crime reduction, where we define an entire neighborhood as the problem, when 90% of the folk in that neighborhood want the crime stopped, right? So we're isolating our allies. Yes, sir.
Thanks. That was a really great presentation. My name is Neil Shaw. I run a startup nonprofit and social enterprise called Code Tenderloin in San Francisco. And I'm glad you brought up Shaka. So a couple of weeks ago, he had an event at the Castro Theater in San Francisco where Van Jones was interviewing him. And I got a chance to talk to him afterwards about Cut 50. And what we're doing in the Tenderloin neighborhood of San Francisco is working with the people with the highest barriers to employment. And a lot of those are young black men that live in Oakland, Vallejo, live in Tenderloin, and need to sell drugs to get by. Mm-hmm. So one of the initiatives we had earlier this week was we had Jeff Adachi, the public defender, sent out his office to do Prop 47 and Clean Slate. I was just wondering if BME operates in San Francisco or the Bay Area and how we can work together and what you think the potential is in the Tenderloin neighborhood specifically.
Yeah, great question. We are not in the Bay Area yet. We want to be, actually. We're in six cities right now. One of the small town, Akron, Baltimore, Detroit, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, and Miami. We're working on DC, and we'd love to be working on the Bay Area. So we're not here yet. And as we start to get this way, I'll be sure to look you up.
Okay. Great, thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thanks so much, Tribune, for this very wonderful presentation. Obed is my name, from Uganda. I traveled purposely for this meeting. I head an institution that is called ACODEV, Action for Community Development, and just taking this reflection forward to beyond what you are doing in America, I just want us to reflect as philanthropists who are here about the relationship between the grassroots movement in terms of respect and dignity for the people that we serve and how we bring this engagement at the table as we make decisions on philanthropy. Because the whole issue is the way we look at people, the way we begin to challenge ourselves of how we reflect on our beings and decision-making processes will determine how people are going to get out of poverty. And therefore, the question I'm asking on is how do we change the way we do things as foundations, as philanthropists, to empower, the grassroots movement in appreciating themselves further?
Thank you, brother. So since I'm of philanthropy, I get to be in these, private meetings and conferences and the like, and we actually train folk on how to asset frame, because this is habit. It's hard to, we think that this is the only way to approach these things because it's the way the whole structure has been. So we're actually working with folk on how to asset frame, which, by the way, is not about PR. It's not about spin. You can't spin poverty, right? Don't waste your time trying to do that stuff. It's just about recognizing that most human beings want the same things, right? Most human beings want safe communities, opportunities for their children, a way to earn a living. And so you can define even folks who have fallen down in ways that don't make them permanently on the ground. Yes, sir.
So this is a quick reinforcing anecdote as opposed to a question. I hope that's okay, because I think
sure
that,
stop,
and it'll be very short, but I think that it's an example of this actually works. Sometimes I think people hear asset framing and they say that sounds nice, but does it actually make a difference?
Right.
My firm serves, not we're a marketing communications firm, you might accuse us of being in the spin business for nonprofits. And one of our clients is called Rancho Cielo in Salinas, California, which has a terrible gang problem. And there's the whole problem thing. And young gang members in Salinas are genuinely scary looking people.
Yeah.
And these gangs are no kidding. They're really serious gangs. Rancho Cielo takes young men and women from the neighborhood that's most affected and essentially just gives them loving attention from a bunch of adults to help them finish school and learn job skills and not see them as a problem. And these kids are transformed within a few months, and recidivism plummets, and the whole thing is they're seen as assets, and you meet them and they're like sweet kids with good hearts, including ones who've committed acts of violence.
Yeah.
And the statistics show the impact is dramatic.
So thanks for that anecdote. I'll share, if you're not already familiar, there's a really interesting stat about who's locked up in prison. Most crimes, not even just violent crimes, but most crimes are committed by folks before they reach the age of 25. Serious crimes are committed by folks before they reach the age of 25. And anyone here actually raise a teenager? Has anyone ever? It turns out, again, according to the research, that their minds aren't even finished developing their full logic processes when someone like Shaka is sent to prison. Or there's another guy in our network named Chris Wilson who was sentenced to natural life in prison at 17, right? He was able to get out, and now he's a leader in Baltimore. He owns two businesses. He really is an asset to the community. But the point being, to lock all these men and women up when they haven't even finished their maturation process is probably a waste.
Thank you so much, Trabian, for this very inspiring session.
You've been listening to a podcast by Stanford Social Innovation Review, a part of the Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society at Stanford University. For more podcasts, articles, and other content about innovating for social change, please visit our website at ssir.org, follow us on Twitter, or like us on Facebook. I'm Eric Nie, and thank you for listening.